Well, hi everyone. Between the years of 1978 and 1990, there were 37 major airplane incidents, including crashes. And 31 of those 37 were traced back to a common cause. And it might not be what you expect. The majority of those crashes were linked to a new advancement in technology called automation. Now, you may wonder why. What's the problem with autopilot features? Well, you'd think that would make flying safer. And yes, autopilot features were intended to help account for pilot error and fatigue and other shortcomings attached to having human beings control every aspect of a flight. But in those early years, autopilot features had a bit of a reverse effect. You want to know what caused those 31 of 37 crashes? The answer was called inadequate pilot monitoring. In other words, nothing had physically failed in those airplanes because of autopilot, but the flight crew had just failed to properly monitor the controls. You see, what happened is as pilots were systematically freed from their responsibilities because of the autopilot takeover, that they were more prone to things like boredom or complacency. They weren't as sharp as they were when they were in full control of the airplane. Now, I think there's a lesson there for some of us. Because some of you are living your life on autopilot. Your marriage, your job, your family. You wake up, you do some stuff, you come home, you go to bed, and you wake up tomorrow and you do that stuff all over again. It's autopilot. And if you're not careful, you can suffer from, you know, inadequate pilot monitoring of your life. Like the gauges are telling you one thing, but you stopped paying attention long ago, and you're headed toward a crash situation. And so what's the answer to the autopilot problem? Well, the answer is to find and live your life mission. To get your life off of autopilot and take control of where you're going. And that's what I want to talk about today. Last week, we started this new series in a new year called On God, Life, and Love by talking about some spiritual disciplines that can get us re-engaged with God. And this week, I want to look at bigger picture and say, let's get in touch with why you're here on the planet. Because everybody, every human being on earth has a mission. Like you were put on earth for a purpose. And when you find your mission, it's going to set your heart on fire. But listen, if you fail to live out the mission for which God has designed and gifted you, at best, you're going to start drifting into autopilot. And at worst, you're going to find some lesser purpose that will act as a substitute. But you can't live in the absence of purpose. The substitute is what John Ortberg called a shadow mission. In fact, he wrote a short book called Overcoming Your Shadow Mission that I'll be drawing some content from today. And a shadow mission is simply an authentic mission that has been derailed, often in small and imperceptible ways. And so it's taking your God-given gifts and passions, and instead of investing them in influence of others for the sake of God's kingdom, you invest them in lesser pursuits, selfish pursuits, like making money or having success or driving a nice car or going through the motions of a safe life. Like it's not like you're 180 degrees off track, but more like 20 degrees off. And I want to help us today to get back to our God-given missions in this life. So here's my big idea. It's simple. God has a mission for you should you choose to accept it. Cue the Mission Impossible theme song in the background of your mind. Now, we're going to look today at the book of Esther in the Old Testament. It's a story of a group of people who are given a choice between a mission and a shadow mission. And destinies get formed and the world gets changed based on their decisions. And I want to give some background on Esther before we totally jump in. So Esther's an incredible book about an amazing woman. In fact, I want to be like her when I grow up. But it's also a controversial book in the Bible. The reformer Martin Luther didn't think that Esther should be in the Bible because through all 9 chapters of the book, God is not mentioned by name even one time. However, if you look closely, you cannot miss seeing God's fingerprints all over this book. Now, you have to understand the plight of the Jewish people throughout Old Testament history. They were God's chosen people, but because of their continued rebellion, God had removed his blessing from them, and the nation fell. They were defeated, and the Jewish people of Jerusalem were taken into captivity in Babylon. And while in Babylon, we read great stories of the Bible, like that of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and we get a glimpse at what life was like in exile under foreign rule. But 50 years later, Persia conquered Babylon. And in so doing, they took control of this large Jewish population who were in exile. And one of those young Jewish girls in exile was named Esther. She'd been adopted by her cousin, Mordecai, and she'd apparently been orphaned by her parents somewhere in the process of being exiled. And so the scene is, we have a young Jewish girl named Esther and her adoptive cousin, Mordecai. And they're in the mighty Persian Empire under the powerful king, Ahasuerus, or sometimes he's called Xerxes. Now, this is one of the best stories in the entire Bible, and I won't do it justice today, and so I want to encourage you to read it on your own this week. You can follow our read plan over at whoisgrace.com/read. But for now, I would love you to turn to Esther in the Bible or your device today. It's two books in front of Psalms. Psalms is right in the middle of your Bible if you just let it flop open, and you'll find Esther two books earlier or on your device at YouVersion. Now, there are four main characters in this book. I've already mentioned three of them. There are Esther and Mordecai, the two Jews in exile. There's Ahasuerus, the Persian king. And then there's Haman, who is the bad guy in the story. He works for King Ahasuerus as his right-hand man, and he has it in for Esther. And so I want to introduce you to these characters, and they're going to help us to explore the idea of finding and living your life mission. And also the sneaky deception and pull of a shadow mission. And at the end, we're going to get very practical and look closely at the passage where this whole story kind of hinges and Esther makes her decision. And listen, on the surface, this looks like a story of a pretty girl and a king and a bad guy. But really, the main character is the one who never gets mentioned. It's God and his mission. And that's what I want you to see today. Now, let me walk you through the characters, and I'm going to summarize the story through them as we lead up to our passage today. So the first is Ahasuerus. He's the king, and he has a shadow mission. His shadow mission revolves around power. And so his empire extends from Asia Minor down into Africa and parts of India. It's huge. And the other characters in this story all seem to revolve around him and his every whim. But it turns out in the end that there's another king who is much greater than Ahasuerus. Anybody ever been to a party that kind of got out of control? Yes? Okay. So turn to the person you're watching with and describe how you behaved at that party. No, don't do that. Wives are looking at their husbands saying, okay, come on, let's hear it, all right? No, don't do that. So chapter one of Esther tells us that Ahasuerus, the king, held a party in his own honor that lasted 180 days. That's 6 months of constant party. It was straight up Animal House. Okay, kids, Animal House was a movie in the late 70s about, you know, never mind. Don't look into it. Anyway, it was a rager, okay? So he's trying to display his vast wealth and the glory of his majesty for all to see. Now, the Bible says that during a drunken episode, Ahasuerus wanted to show off his prized possession, his queen, Queen Vashti. Now, what do you suppose he wanted to show off about her? You think it was her intellect? Like, did he want her to parade out of the castle and do math problems for people? No. Well, maybe her insight, like have her come out and do a quick TED talk on the decline of the Babylonian Empire? No. He wanted to show off her beauty in a very humiliating and misogynistic way. But an incredible thing happens. Queen Vashti turns back to this powerful king and she says, "No, thank you. You mean parade myself before a crazed mob after months and months of drinking? I'm good." And so she tells the king to hit the road. Well, the king becomes furious and he burns with anger. You see, when his shadow mission of power was threatened, like he went off the deep end. And so he got rid of that queen. But soon the king got lonely, and he also hit rock bottom. History tells us that he had undertaken a disastrous military campaign against Greece. He lost his naval fleet and much of his army. And his young advisors finally come to him, and they say, "Do you know what you need? You need a new queen." And can you imagine what the number one criteria was that he was looking for those who interviewed to be the queen? She had to be beautiful. And so each of the 127 provinces sent a representative girl, probably between 14 and 16 years old. It's weird, I know. And the king had himself an old-fashioned beauty pageant. Hundreds of girls competing to be the king's trophy wife. Enter Esther, the hero of our story. She won the pageant. She becomes the new queen. Now, why she entered, we're not sure. Was she coerced? Was she nominated? It certainly would have meant good things for her province, so I'm sure there was a lot of pressure on her. But regardless how she got there, she won. But here's the thing. Esther had a secret that nobody knew, including the king. She was a Jew. But under strict orders from her cousin and guardian, Mordecai, she hid her identity. Mordecai knew that if the king and his advisors found out that Esther was a Jewess, that they would reject her without giving her a second look. And so if she wanted to win a pagan king's favor, it would come at the price of hiding her true identity. Her Jewish name was Hadassah, but her Persian name was Esther, now Queen Esther. Now, the third character you need to know is Haman. He was second in command to the king. His position had gone to his head. Haman was one of those people who can't stop talking about himself. Have you ever met this guy? Like telling you about everything that he knows, telling you about everything that he can do, how strong he is, how much he can bench press. Okay, he never shuts up about himself. Haman's shadow mission revolved around approval. He was always looking for people to flatter him and inflate his already oversized ego. Now, Haman had worked out a little arrangement. Whenever he walked by on the streets or anywhere, everyone he walked by had to bow down to him in this kind of elaborate, weird tribute. He had some issues. But people went along with Haman's little ego trips because, well, he had the king's ear, and therefore he had the ability to have people killed. And nobody wanted to pay the price for not going along with Haman's little stunts. Well, almost nobody. There was one guy who wasn't having any of it. His name was Mordecai. Yes, this is Esther's cousin and guardian. He was the one who raised this new little queen when her parents died. And Mordecai had decided that this nonsense with bowing down to Haman had gone on long enough, and it was time to stand up. And so Mordecai refused to bow down. And as you would expect from an egomaniac, Haman was furious. When he discovered that Mordecai was a Jew, well, that was even more appalling. And so Haman decided to bide his time. He hatched a plot, and he went to King Ahasuerus, and he informed the king of a people, God's people, who are nonconformists. These are insurrectionists. These are revolutionaries. They posed an imminent threat to the king. All this, by the way, because one guy wouldn't abide by Haman's dumb rule. But Haman convinced the king that it was in the king's best interest to completely annihilate all Jewish exiles by genocide. Haman even offered to personally finance the project. But by the way, as an aside, this provides an incredible portrait of what prejudice looks like. Haman thought, well, one of them did this to me. Therefore, here's the leap, all of them must be the same way. What's true of one must be true of all, and so let's deal with them all together. This is what prejudice thinking does in a smaller scale in all of us. I apply my perception of one person to the whole group of people that that person represents in my mind. But that's for another sermon at another time. And so Haman comes to the king and he says, one Jewish man disobeyed me. Let's kill them all. And without blinking, the king gives a nod of approval. Remember, no one knows that the new queen is also Jewish, nor do they know that she's a relative to public enemy number one, Mordecai. And so posters are soon plastered all over the empire saying, kill all the Jews. This was the Holocaust before the Holocaust. Young and old, women and children, on the 13th day of the 12th month, there will be a mass genocide by the state. But also, the people of Persia are just encouraged. Like, if you live next to a Jewish person on March 7th, if you're going to be a good citizen, you go ahead and kill them yourself, okay? So at the beginning of Esther chapter 4, when Mordecai hears about this, he tears his clothes. He puts on sackcloth and ashes, and he goes into the streets, wailing loudly and bitterly. And now, this wasn't just an expression of grief. This was an act of protest. And in those days, protesting wasn't protected by a First Amendment. It was punishable by death. And so Mordecai's protest was an act of extraordinary courage. But it soon becomes clear to him that if anything productive is going to be done, if the Jewish people are going to be saved, there's only one shot to turn this thing around. It's going to be up to Esther. She's the one on the inside. She's going to need to risk her life to save her people on the outside. And so Mordecai goes to her and he meets with her through some messengers. This young girl whom he raised, this beauty queen, the king's supposed trophy wife. And he says, Esther, you're going to have to step up. Like, you need to go to the very dangerous and unpredictable king. You're going to have to go turn this whole deal around. And for good reason, Esther's first reaction is, yeah, I'm not going to do that. And I want to focus the rest of our time today on the decision point in this story. Because I'm convinced that there are some of you today who are at a similar decision point in your life. Will you step into God's mission for you? And listen, it probably won't cost you your literal life, but it may cost you things, money and reputation and energy and courage. But I'm firmly convinced, as our big idea says, that God has a mission for you should you choose to accept it. So we're going to pick up the story in Esther chapter 4, verse 11. And I want to talk about four lessons on finding and living your life mission. So would you look at Esther 4, verse 11. Esther's responding here to Mordecai's request to go in and talk to the king. And so she's talking to him through a messenger. She said this. She said, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law: to be put to death, except the one whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. And so they told Mordecai what Esther had said. And then Mordecai told them to reply back to Esther. Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. So here's the first lesson, is to identify your truth teller. Like, I don't think Esther would have stepped into her life's mission if she didn't have a truth teller like Mordecai framing the situation for her. Now think about the position he was in. This is the little girl that you raised. This is the little girl that's now expressing to you that she's afraid. Like, what you're asking her to do is too hard. It's too scary. It's a death wish. Now most folks, most friends would stop at this point, and they would say to Esther, listen, I understand, never mind, don't do it. Not Mordecai. He's going to challenge her. Mordecai says, listen, I know exactly what I'm asking. If you don't risk losing the comfort of this palace, you're going to lose everything. Mordecai wasn't shy in asking Esther to do something great for God. I love how he says it in verse 14. He says, listen, if you don't do this, relief and deliverance will come from another place. In other words, God will do something great through someone else. But what if it gets to be you? Do you have somebody like this in your life? Is there somebody in your life who's pushing you to do great things? Who's pushing you to take some risks? Who's calling you to spiritually step up? Do you have a truth teller in your life? See, Mordecai presses her. He says, Esther, we didn't know it at the time, but God put you in there, like right where you are, not so that you could have an exquisite wardrobe, not so that you could have precious gems or exotic fragrances. Esther, you are where you are because God placed you there for this moment, to work for justice and to spare a people a great suffering and to oppose a man who is vile and evil and supremely powerful. You have been brought to this point in your life to be a part of God's plan to redeem the world. And so don't let any of the trappings of wealth or beauty or comfort blind you to what God says your life is really about. And listen, if you say no to God here, if you miss this, as frightening as it is, you might miss the reason why you are on this planet. This is your moment, Esther. This is it. You know, sometimes God calls people directly, like he shows up and talks to them himself. He did it with Moses. He did it that way with Paul. But often he uses a spokesperson, a truth teller, as he does here with Esther. Do you have a Mordecai? Like, do you have someone who's shooting straight with you? You have someone who doesn't settle for your excuses, who kind of sees through all that. I fear that not enough of you do. You know, a sharply growing number of Americans say that they have no one in their life in whom they can confide. They don't have a close friend or a confidant. We keep getting richer in stuff and poorer in people. So do you have somebody that you can regularly speak, you know, truth to, and they'll speak truth into your life, who loves you but is not impressed by you, who's going to listen to God on your behalf, who will exhort you when what you say you believe and how you act are not matching up? Like, I'm convinced that it's possible to have a truth teller, and that it's impossible to consistently live in your life's true mission without one, without a Mordecai. We drift too easily. And here's the other thing. Are you a Mordecai to someone else? Like, do you have someone that you're investing in, that you're cheering on, that you're speaking the truth to? This is part of the role of the church. This is part of the role of fellow Christians. It's why we're kind of nuts around here about helping people to get into life groups, into these little communities where we can grow and encourage and challenge each other to live into our true missions. We're working hard all this month to help people to find groups like this. In fact, you can go over to whoisgrace.com/lifegroups to check it out anytime. And I'd encourage you that if you're going to have any shot at living your life mission or growing spiritually even, you absolutely need a truth teller and some authentic community around you in your life. So here's the second lesson. It's to overcome what paralyzes you. Like, Esther knew what was at stake, and she was paralyzed. There were fears running through her mind. We can hear it in verse 11. It was all stacked against her. First, it was a capital offense to go into the king without him calling for you. Second, remember what happened to the last queen who decided that she was going to be bold. Third, we find out that the king hadn't called for Esther for 30 days, which means she was already out of his favor for some reason. This is not a good scenario for Esther, and she was paralyzed by it. She had some major soul searching to do. And I don't want to pretend to know all that was going on inside her, but I do know from experience that often the root cause of what paralyzes us from doing what God asks us to do is when a shadow mission takes over. So did Esther get into the palace and get comfortable? I mean, how could you not? Was she on autopilot? So that when the risky thing that God was calling her to do came along, it looked much more risky than it actually was. You see, our shadow mission is often connected to what the Bible calls an idol in our lives. I mentioned this during the Jonah series, but it's worth coming back to. Pastor Tim Keller makes a distinction between what he calls near idols and far idols. Near idols are those that immediately present themselves and they come to mind, things like money or success. But far idols are tougher. They're the deeper hidden structures that allow those things to become ultimate in our lives. And he suggests that there are four far idols or root idols. They are power, control, comfort, and approval. Power is just a longing for influence or recognition. Control, a longing to have everything go according to my plan. Comfort, a longing for pleasure. And approval, a longing to be accepted or desired. And so many Americans have a near idol of money or wealth, for example. But the root issue, the far idol, can be different from person to person. And so someone with a far idol of power wants more money because of the status money can offer. If the far idol is control, money will eliminate uncertainty and will gain more control of my future. The person with a comfort idol as a far idol wants all the new toys and creature comforts that they will now be able to afford. And the person with an approval far idol wants to use those new toys simply to win friends. And I wonder if comfort had become an idol for Esther. Like if she kind of had a shadow mission that creeped in that said, if you just maintain the status quo, if you just keep everything comfortable, you're going to do some good for your people in the end. Think about her life. She'd gone from being an orphan to having achieved the highest status of any woman in the land. She'd allowed herself to fit right into the culture's norms of beauty queens. She'd sold her soul a bit on the way to the top, and maybe she had become comfortable. Maybe she had kind of drifted into a shadow mission, and Mordecai's speech was like two hands on her shoulders, shaking her back to reality, saying, God has something more for you. He has a mission should you choose to accept it. You need to go into the king. You need to reveal your true identity. You need to advocate for the lives of your people before we're all killed. Snap out of autopilot. Snap out of your paralysis and accept your mission from God. And maybe, just maybe, says Mordecai, you have come into the kingdom for such a time as this. This is your time. What is it that paralyzes you from attempting great things for God? Like, what's your go-to excuse when you're asked to serve and when you're asked to step up? What's the excuse that you use? Because that excuse is probably going to point you to your idol or your shadow mission. If you're going to grab a hold of your true life mission, you're going to have to deal with what paralyzes you. I want you to see the next lesson, number three. It's to spiritually prepare to make decisions. Look at verse 15. It says, then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And I and my young women will also fast as you do. And so we can see Esther is processing through this enormous decision. Her fear and paralysis is melting away, and she's starting to entertain the idea of going into the king and risking her life for her people. And once that thought pops into her mind, her first instinct after that is to fast and pray. Not only that, it's to call on everyone she knows who believes in God to fast and pray with her. For 3 days of fasting among the Jews and among her friends. And this was a food and water fast. It's the serious kind. And so we talked last week about the importance of integrating certain spiritual disciplines into our lives, and fasting is one of those ancient disciplines. It's eliminating something, usually food, so that we can concentrate our hearts and minds on God. Biblical fasting always has to do with eliminating distractions for a spiritual purpose. It hits the reset button of our soul, and it renews us from the inside out. And so we see Esther here, when the stakes are high, turning to those disciplines that are going to connect her to God. And now, from this point forward in the narrative, Esther is on offense, no longer on defense. Mordecai is no longer calling the shots. He doesn't make one single decision from this point forward. Esther, under God's directive, is the one calling the shots. The season of fasting has given her like a power and a confidence that she needs. And from here on, she devises and executes the plan. Sweet little, pretty little Esther, who never rocks the boat, who never ruffles any feathers, she starts giving orders. She's transformed from eye candy into a powerful woman of God, willing to risk it all by standing before a king who could execute her on a whim. You know, early in the narrative, Esther's motives were suspect. Her identity was vague. Now she is exactly sure of who she truly is. And so fasting and prayer are this critical thing. Like, when we face important decisions, they focus us on the spiritual side of things. They give us perspective because we're connecting with God. And I would ask you, what are the key decisions that are going to help you to live your life's mission? Like job decisions, family decisions, relational decisions, financial, relocation. You know, we've all got these decisions. My question to you is, are you spiritually preparing for them? And the ancient techniques still work, guys. Fasting and prayer and gathering others around you to do the same. Have you asked your friends, your family, your life group to join you in fasting for God's direction? It's an important lesson. Here's the fourth. It's to leverage your life for the good of others. Look at verses 16, the second part, and 17. She has listened to her truth teller. She's dealt with her paralyzing idols. She has spiritually prepared through fasting. Now look. It says, then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Whew. She said, I'm going to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I die, I die. This power monger of a king, he's got no idea what he signed up for when he made Esther the queen. He doesn't have a clue. So let's generalize just a little. We're not in the same situation, but there's a remarkable principle here that has broad application to us, and it's this. God has perfectly positioned you to influence someone. Like for Esther, it was the king. But maybe right now for you, it's your children. Maybe it's a friend. Maybe it's a boss or a fiance. Maybe it's an entire neighborhood. Maybe it's a department at work. But I want to remind you that wherever you have been positioned, it's a gift from God. And how you leverage that position is an act of worship to God. So maybe you are where you are, not to further your own career, not to make more for yourself, but as a way of service to those outside your circle, for her outside the palace. Like Esther, maybe you have to be willing to risk your standing, to risk your credentials, your connections, your money for the good of others, for the poor, for the struggling, for the kingdom of God. And if you're not willing to even consider that, maybe your castle has become a prison and it's already consumed your soul. See, Esther finally saw her life through a bigger lens. It was a kingdom lens. Suddenly she realized that her passion and her gifts and her unparalleled access to the king had come together for this specific assignment from God for the good of others. You and I need to take on that perspective too. Like, did you ever think that maybe God has you in your situation for a very specific assignment, for such a time as this? And when's the last time you asked him, how can I leverage my life? Like, where you've placed me, the access you've given me, the networks you've granted me, where can I leverage those things for the good of others? There's a passage in 1 Corinthians 7 that says, only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. Did you hear that? You have a calling and you have an assignment. And I'm convinced that some of you are where you are for such a time as this. It's time to speak up for someone who doesn't have a voice. You see injustices that need to be made right, or you notice people who need to be loved, or someone who needs just a fresh start. Maybe God is trying to reveal your mission to you. Now listen. I'm going to refer you to our read plan to discover the ending of this story. It's a really good and amazing ending, but I want you to work through it on your own this week at whoisgrace.com/read. There are going to be some great resources over there for you too. Not the least of which is that Esther, it's going to point us to this fact that Esther is not just a great example for us, but she's also a signpost that points us to Jesus, the one with ultimate power and beauty, the one with an ultimate palace who used his ultimate power and his ultimate position to save his people. He's the one who provides the foundation for us to have a meaningful mission in life. And he also provides us the power to live it out, to walk it out. So would you do something today as a next step, as a very kind of initial step here? Would you identify and reach out to your truth teller? Like, who is that for you? I'd really encourage you to do that work. Invite them back in to share words of encouragement to you and challenge with you. Ask them what they think is your life mission and if you're fully living into it right now. If you don't have one, you can head over to and even if you do, you can head over to whoisgrace.com/lifegroups and check out a group. It will be one of the best things you've ever done. I love you guys. God bless you. See you next week.